This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Okay, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming out. I know it's getting late in the quarter for students. It's a beautiful day and we haven't had so many of those lately, so we appreciate that you carved out a bit of time for us. Want to give special thanks to community members who've come out. So it's good to see folks. So we really appreciate you being here. And know that all of our events are open to the community, and please come back for more if you can. I'm Greg Johnson, director of the Walter H. Capp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life here at UCSB, and also a professor of religious studies. It's really a great honor to welcome our guest. I'll say just more in a moment, but first a land acknowledgement. We all know that we're on Chumash land. It continues to be Chumash land, vital to Chumash peoples in this area. Our university hasn't always done right by our Chumash neighbors. I think we are turning the corner on some issues, repatriation in particular, some co-management initiatives and so forth, but we need to keep doing right by these folks, enfranchising them, particularly creating pathways for their students to join us here at UCSB and work with us. That takes keeping pressure. Students, I'm talking to you on administration when issues come up to say this is a real need. We can't keep doing performative things like land acknowledgments if we're not going to follow through. So let's do that work together. Okay. These political times, we didn't know when we were organizing the events for this half of the year how relevant they would be. In fact, of course, we all regret how relevant these talks might be, but alas, here we are, and we at least have the right people to speak with us about the issues we're facing together. And today, tonight, is absolutely no exception to that. An urgent, important topic of long-standing relevance that's timely once again. We are excited to welcome you to today's talk by Professor Lloyd Barbara on Making a Refuge of Resistance, a History of the U.S. Sanctuary Movement. We're honored that you could be here with us today. The CAP Center is also grateful to our co-sponsor for this evening's lecture, the Departments of Religious Studies and History, so thank you to them. Lloyd Barbara is Assistant Professor of Religion and Core Faculty in Latinx and Latin American Studies at Amherst College. He is the author of Sowing the Sacred, Mexican Pentecostal Farm Workers in California, and editor of Oneness, Pentecostalism, Race, Gender, and Culture, and also of Latin American and U.S. Latino Religion in North America. He has also written many articles and book chapters. Most recently, he has co-created and co-hosted the podcast series Sanctuary, on the border between church and state. Dr. Barbara is currently working on a history of the U.S. sanctuary movement, a book about Cesar Chavez, and they're both under contract with Oxford University Press. And this guy's audacious. We were chatting earlier, and I said, how is that project going? He says, better and faster than expected. Academics don't talk that way. Who even are you? That's what I want to know. Don't you know we say, oh, I'm behind and I missed the deadline again. So just remember, it makes the rest of us feel a little bit crummy when you're so optimistic and productive. No, we are genuinely thrilled that you could carve out time at the end of a semester and before the summer research season. We know it's not a small thing to travel across the country to do this kind of work. We're going to benefit from it. So welcome. It's great to have you here.
Well, it's great to be in what I've been calling all day today, Santa Barbara. I want to say thanks to Drs. Dusty Osley and Greg Johnson for facilitating this visit, David Walker, Cory Booker, Cory Tucker Price, sorry, and Joe Blankholm. I'm used to Joseph, and I say Joe, so I'm getting things mixed-matched. My bad. All the folks in the CAP Center, Leilani, where are you? Somewhere here. Thank you so much for, again, facilitating, walking me over. It's easy to get lost in a place you've never been to before, right? So it happens. Thank you. So coming from a liberal arts school, I'm from Amherst College. We have 1,800 students, right? This place is ginormous, ginormous compared to Amherst College. And teaching at a place like Amherst College, one is often on an island intellectually where I'm the one Americanist. in religion. And so it's Santa Barbara refreshing to be among historians and scholars of American religion. And I come to this topic that I'm presenting about today from the training in Latinx religion and immigration history, and still surprised that scholars of religion have scarcely touched this topic of sanctuary. Today I'll share a bit of my next book project, title similar there, Refuge of Resistance, A History of the U.S. Sanctuary Movement. And thanks to a recent grant by the American Council of Learned Societies, the manuscript will make an on-time departure off my desk next year. But until then, you can check out the longer a longer version of part two of the talk, part two of today's talk, in which I discuss this concept of usable sacred histories. That'll be in the forthcoming issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, though with far fewer images than you'll see today. I also wanted to distribute these flyers. This is, if you could help me, Greg and Dusty, that'd be great. That's for the podcast, Sanctuary on the Border Between Church and State. It's a 7-episode limited podcast series I co-wrote and co-hosted with historian Sergio Gonzalez from Marquette University. And it's produced by UC Santa Barbara religion PhD Brad Onishi and his wonderful team at Access Mundi Media. So back to the book and today's topic. A Refuge of Resistance covers the long history of the sanctuary movement from the 1980s to the present day. Historians who study the kind of material that I do, we really wish that this material would not be relevant again. But here we are in 2025, a time when the mayors of sanctuary cities have been summoned to appear before Congress for a hearing. And just last week, the president signed an executive order aimed to punish and criminalize sanctuary city leaders just on April 28th. So this is all hitting us at once. In recent months, many of us perhaps have started to see signposts such as you see on the slide. Congregations have decided that in light of the rescission of the sensitive locations memo under the current administration, that a clear demarcation of sacred space is once again necessary. So on the left-hand side, St. Paul and St. Andrew's Church, welcome, ICE and Homeland Security is not permitted, and who to contact. And on the right, more of a template used by the California Pacific Conference of the United Methodist Church, indicating the private property notice, and this church is private property. Unauthorized entry, including the ICE, Homeland Security, without a signed Jewish warrant, is not permitted. These have begun to abound in recent weeks and months. Today's talk focuses on the 1980s, a time when there was no such thing as a sensitive locations memo. The first sensitive locations memo, featured there on the left, sanctuary organizers under the New Sanctuary Movement, launched in 2006, helped to push forward, and that was signed in 2011. By Obama, and then in 2021, Biden signed one it's very similar in content. It was called Protected Areas Memo. And Trump in his first term did not formally rescind the 2011 memo, and that's probably because the focus of his first term was immigrant exclusion via a wall rather than immigrant expulsion via deportation. And now, as we know, sanctuary is in the crosshairs of the administration. And again, as obvious in the executive order that he signed just last week, it's titled Protecting American Communities from Criminal Aliens. It's obvious what the concerns are here. In the White House press release the same day, it quotes Trump describing sanctuary cities as death traps, making no small deal of the alleged violence that he cites in these sorts of places. But those sorts of statistics contravene all of the empirical research showing that sanctuary cities are not just, in many cases, safer, but again, the kind of work that folks need to do to undo the harm of that kind of discursive violence also show that immigrants, especially those without documentation, are far less likely than your average or your American citizen to commit crime. So it really just contravenes a host of research on that. A couple of weeks ago, I published a very short write-up for the Public Religion Research Institute. And I was accessing a report on the Department of Justice website. It was right around February 21st or so, I'd say. And I was working with the report online. Luckily, I had other means to access it, but 2 days later, the report had been pulled as many articles and databases were being redacted from government databases. And that report, again, was one of the empirical studies about the lack or the negative correlation between immigration and crime, or immigrants and crime, to be specific. So again, there was no sensitive locations memo in the 1980s, and that's a historical fact that sheds much light on the current moment and tactics of sacred resistance. So allow me to begin by first discussing, with really broad brushstrokes, what is the sanctuary movement? I'm going to give you a quick 4-minute overview of something I've been contracted to do in 100,000 words, but I'll do my best. So I do this to set up an effort towards focusing on the rituals of memory that render sanctuary a refuge of resistance. And in this talk, I try to answer, what is it about sacred spaces that have kept immigration officers away from entering churches? So first, the sanctuary movement is a peace tradition originally founded upon religious principles of offering refuge and mediation for individuals in a legally precarious circumstance. That's, again, the very basic premise upon which it's founded. And notice no reference yet to immigration, okay? The sort of the long-standing principle of sanctuary. But since the 1980s, it's been an interfaith movement dedicated to providing sanctuary to undocumented immigrants at risk of deportation. I specify interfaith and religious because, as you're likely well aware, there are many more forms of sanctuary, including sanctuary cities like Los Angeles and Santa Barbara in the 80s, well, I guess LA as well in the present day. There's also sanctuary campuses, places like Oberlin College. There was an effort among the UCs as well. These cities and campuses are no small part within the broader sanctuary movement, as I explained in the book manuscript, but they're not quite the focus of today's talk. Sanctuary stands out as the most confrontational progressive religious social justice movement in the U.S. since the heyday of the Civil Rights Movement. It also gives us a broader picture of the kinds of religious activism happening in the 1980s. And according to historian Christina Scholl, sanctuary is, quote, the largest mass mobilization of civil disobedience against detention and deportation in U.S. history. What struck me over the years of researching the movement has been how scholars of religion have paid such little attention to sanctuary. Legal scholars, sure. Political scientists, yes. Anthropologists, sociologists, certainly they've picked up on it. The entire concept of sanctuary, after all, is founded upon religious principles. So I think it's high time for scholars of religion to examine this tradition. So to get to this overview, the sanctuary movement generally refers to two movements separated by over a decade, but closely related in rhetoric, tactic, and to some extent shared goals. The original sanctuary movement of the 80s provided support for Central American refugees fleeing the violence of US-backed civil wars in Central America. Activists of the 80s, unlike those of the new sanctuary movement, again, officially starting in 2006, made the case that those fleeing El Salvador and Guatemala should be recognized as refugees and not, as the Reagan administration was insisting, economic migrants. That's the phrase used over and over. They're economic migrants, they're not refugees. Official numbers are a bit difficult to ascertain given the really grassroots nature and sometimes clandestine nature of sanctuary. But we can account for about 500 congregations across the U.S. in the 80s that officially declared sanctuary. Movement insiders and experts at the time suggested that for every declared sanctuary, about 10 other congregations were assisting. So do the math, and you're talking about a really sizable movement in the 80s. Sure, many people think religion and the 1980s and progressive religion is likely the last thing on your mind, given the rise of the religious right. The new sanctuary movement kicked off in the summer of 2006 when Elvira Arellano, shown there, very publicly, press conference and such, took sanctuary at Adalberto United Methodist Church in Chicago. This happened amid the debates regarding comprehensive immigration reform, as some of you might remember from 2005 to 2008. And to be clear, no, we still didn't get comprehensive immigration, right? No comprehensive immigration reform. Back in 2019, one of my co-authors and I published an open access article in which we described this long arc of sanctuary activism. We identified a second wave of the sanctuary movement that swept over the country in the weeks and months following Trump's first election. And this continued well into his first term. According to Church World Service, within months of the 2016 election, the number of sanctuary congregations in the U.S. doubled from 400 to 800. And by 2018, the number nearly tripled the original number, reaching over 1,100 congregations. Sanctuary activism has ebbed since Trump is no longer in office, in the time when Trump was no longer in office, and during the Biden administration, where a lot of the sanctuary organizers shifted to do more work with asylum seekers. And in the weeks following Biden's inauguration, many who had been in sanctuary left. So here on the slide is a photo from a service I attended in Amherst, at the First Church Amherst. The community joyfully gathered to celebrate Lucio Perez's exit from sanctuary after 3.5 years in the church. To be clear, it's not because, you know, Lucio and others didn't exit because Biden is some great immigrant rights hero. That's not the reason. It has more to do with the fact that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was then no longer operating at Trump's imperatives, including zero tolerance policy. So many received stays of deportation, some went into anonymity in cities. So in short, one pattern we see since the 80s is that sanctuary arises when the state has utterly failed vulnerable immigrants. And since we're in Santa Barbara, I'm gonna do some local history here. From the University of Washington's archives, there's a list of sanctuary organizations. I believe this one is from, from 87. And so it lists a couple of sites here in town, including the Jewish Congregation B'nai B'rith, the University of California Campus Sanctuary Network, and the Unitarian Society here locally. As well as, I found this really quite intriguing, the Franciscan Friars of Santa Barbara, if you follow with me here in this this penultimate sentence. When the formal vote to declare sanctuary was taken, an overwhelming number voted with 75% in favor. Their rules call for 30% or more passage. Santa Barbara is the first OFM province in America to take this stand. I found that really, really fascinating, given the robust nature of Catholic sanctuary activism in the 80s. Also, as I mentioned very briefly, I found record of Santa Barbara as a sanctuary city. So just about a month ago, I published with Sergio Gonzalez, my co-host, co-author, an article in Time magazine making the point that sanctuary cities are not something new, even though they've been brought to the surface because of the attacks against sanctuary cities. They've been around for a while. And again, the core principle that matters in sanctuary cities is arguing a different article in ARCMAG is the non-cooperation agreement that local law enforcement, they're doing their job. They're not going to do the bidding of federal law enforcement. And that is really the point of contention in Trump's executive order signed last week. Okay, one more. Also, the petition to make UC Santa Barbara Sanctuary Campus that was circulated, I have it timed to about November, December 2016, but perhaps as late as January 2017, which is really not that much later. It's just as a historian, I strive for precision. I can't always get it, so hence the circa. And also, thanks to Dr. Hosley today, my quick trip to the special collections here on campus shows and indicates that there's a whole lot more research to be done on the new sanctuary movement in 2006, 2007, 2008 in Santa Barbara and in the area here. Okay, let's zoom out real quick again. So my own take is that sanctuary is a refuge of resistance. In that framing, the concept of sanctuary rests on this ostensible contradiction. Sanctuary is a place of refuge, or think rest, that is founded upon relentless resistance, or think struggle. Although the terms refuge and resistance seem to be antithetical, these concepts work hand in hand in the sanctuary movement. They have allowed the movement to successfully tap into a tradition of religious and cultural resistance without dispensing of its forceful scriptural and historical precedent of refuge. On the slide, we have a newspaper clipping showing sanctuary workers who don't seem to be all that upset about their conviction. And this stems from the 1985-1986 sanctuary trial, a trial that resulted from a joint Immigration Naturalization Services, INS, and FBI operation in which three men were sent to infiltrate the sanctuary movement and to spy. So they call it spies in the pews, which is actually quite appropriate. And that developed eventually into the sanctuary trial of 85 to 86. The goal was to take down some of the sanctuary organizers, the key organizers in Tucson. Ultimately, there was convictions against eight of them, but in the court of public opinion, they prevailed. So it was really much more of a Pyrrhic victory for the Reagan administration. So today I want to focus on two main points in answering, is sacred space protected space? Now, if you thought you'd get a straightforward answer from an academic, the joke's on you. Here's my answer, as best as I can frame it. So far, yes, as far as it concerns undocumented immigrants. And with that answer in mind, I want to describe a twofold process of the creation of this sacred or inviolable space for Central American refugees in the 80s. This two process of creating sacred space. Number one, I want to focus on testimonials that the refugees shared in congregations, in very public sort of formats where they spoke about the violence in Central America. And number two, this concept of usable sacred histories, a core feature of any congregation's declaration or resolution of sanctuary. So in the academic study of religion, the longtime prevailing idea, thanks to someone like Mircea Eliade, was that sacred space was sacred due to an inherent quality about the space being transformed by a divine event, or what he called a hierophany. But today, I want us to consider a different kind of process that defines sacred space. For this, we're back in Santa Barbara for this. Two UCSB religion PhDs, religion scholars David Chittister and Edward Leinenthal, who designate this idea of situational sacred space. So according to Chittister and Leinenthal, in the formulation of sacred space, quote, nothing is inherently sacred, but sites or objects become sacred through, quote, the human consecration, or through human consecration as a result of the cultural labor of ritual in specific historical situations. And I want to consider 1980s sanctuary as such. This cultural labor of ritual involves the hard work of attention, memory, design, construction, and control of place. Given these elements of ritual, attention, memory, design, construction, and control of place, Chittister and Leinenthal conclude that sacred space is contested space. Now, to be clear, this doesn't mean that that contested space is necessarily sacred space, but they're implying that the converse is true. And we can see this in the cultural labor of ritual at play in both the testimonials offered by the refugees themselves and in the demarcation of sacred space, invoking God, morality, and a long shared history. The ritual labor of testifying, the testimonials, identified the profaning agent, while the declarations of sanctuary ritually set parameters around the house of worship. The sanctuary movement, after all, had no legal basis upon which to declare sanctuary. Houses of worship became protective spaces as both a threat was ritually identified in the testimonials and a sacred demarcation was pronounced in the sanctuary declaration. So this is, again, to follow their definition, a specific historical situation that involved the hard work of attention, memory, design, construction, and control of place. I think this is demonstrated by the testimonials and the usable sacred histories. So let's first look at the refuge of resistance in greater detail through testimonials. Again, sanctuary, a peace tradition, began in the 1980s as a response to violence and threats to human life. So any narration of the movement must account for the widespread violence in Central America. Those who testified in front of congregations and various audiences across the U.S. sought to mobilize their experiences into an eventual victory over a government back home intent on denying them basic human rights as outlined in international law, and they sought a rightful designation as refugees under the U.S. Refugee Act of 1980, not signed by Reagan, but by Jimmy Carter. Accounts of heinous acts of violence filled the lament of the broader Central America peace movement, more generally, and the sanctuary movement in particular. State-sanctioned violence impacted civilians, sympathizers, even suspected sympathizers, their family, their acquaintances. It was a wide net of suspicion that was cast upon anyone who suspected to be a sympathizer. Simply put, we cannot understand the gravitas of the claim that those who fled were refugees without grasping the nature and the sheer scale of violence during the civil wars. In the current draft of the book, I detail these forms of violence as testified to by the refugees themselves. Today, time doesn't permit this kind of setup required to discuss this, so suffice it to say, in the words of one anonymous refugee, it was better to flee than to wait for death, and that's a really recurring theme in the testimonials. And I usually refrain from leading with statistics to prove significance, but given today's time constraints and that this is an open lecture, I'll mention just a few figures. So by the end of the Civil War in El Salvador, the death toll reached 75,000, or over 1% of the country's population, and over 500,000 individuals displaced. The Center for Justice and Accountability reported that over 200,000 Guatemalans were killed or forcibly disappeared in the civil war that raged from 1960 to 1996. They also document that 93% of these human rights violations were carried out by government forces. All these forms of violence and the potential silencing weighed heavily on the minds of the refugees as they made the decision to step before congregations and to testify. Their voices and their testimonials signaled their refusal to be silent, even in the face of a government back home that attempted to disappear them and a government in the U.S. that was intent on denying them a story and saying they're economic migrants, they're not refugees. So refugees understood this form of public witness as testimonials. And more than some simple sort of translation of an English cognate testimony, in Latin America, testimonial assumes a particular valence. At its most basic level, the term testimonial, per Hispanic literary critic John Beverly, you'll see on the slide, carries a connotation of an act of truth-telling in a religious or legal sense. And in this context of sanctuary, testimonials assumed overt aspects of both of the religious and the legal, as refugees spoke to religious audiences to appeal to morality and conscience in hopes of changing existing U.S. policy. As acts of truth-telling, the testimonials also, quote, a story that needs to be told, and the emphasis is original to Beverly. What defined need here were the conditions under which the witnesses were being systematically silenced by a state power that governed law and has suspended the free press. To speak back, or in other words, to deliver a testimonial, constituted a direct challenge. Testimonials work amid asymmetrical power relations and thus constitute a type of resistance literature. The last point there. Absent these points, one may very well fail to realize why refugee testimonials operated in this particular critical register. Per Beverly, testimonials convey a sense of uncanniness on the part of the person offering the testimonial and the aesthetic of the testimonial. There is sort of a gut-wrenching and a calling to attention quality of testimonials. Now, again, to think of how this would, the way this information is supposed to hit you, I'll have to cover the mic for this, but it has a sort of this aesthetic of, hey, you there, right? Utterly grab your attention, gut-wrenching, and is supposed to change hearts and minds. It's meant to utterly disturb you. Again, hopes of raising consciousness, changing hearts and minds, and engendering action, or as my colleague Sergio Gonzalez says, it's meant to educate and to activate. If you're just educating, not activating, it's missing the goal. You have to have both parts together. So, testimonials. Refugees made clear why the stories needed to be told. In November 85, Emilio, pictured here with his family, took sanctuary in Chicago with his wife Gladys and their three children. It was often the case that refugees testified at sanctuary declaration services. So when a congregation wanted to declare sanctuary, they might have someone who was taking sanctuary either at that church or the temple or somewhere nearby offer their testimonial. Emilio made his reasons clear for leaving El Salvador. He stated, my government ordered me to leave the country or appear among the disappeared. So there were push factors as well as pull factors in all this. Ana Toledo de la Cruz described her decision to flee the bloody experiences of Guatemala for the U.S. because a platform that sanctuary afforded one to testify. She recalled, I made the decision to come here because sanctuary was going to help us and because we wanted to keep helping our people by talking to the North American people about the reality of our country. So pervasive was the violence that far too many of the sanctuary refugees carried the testimonials on their bodies. Some of them who had survived mutilation testified and as they showed their scars and wounds left by their captors. From sanctuary, Mario Castillo, a medical student, shared how, quote, the police captured and tortured me. I still have the signs of torture on my body. Others, to stay the mouths of these doubting Thomases, would show journalists their wounds. In these cases, sanctuaries transcended the category of resistance literature by becoming bodily or corporal witnesses to violence. Sanctuary seekers also, again, they understood this platform that sanctuary provided. This is the case of Estella, who took sanctuary in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she testified about her time in sanctuary. So this is actually, this quote is from 1987, when she was at a Jerome Hall Forum at Harvard Divinity School. She reflected on her time in sanctuary at Cambridge. So she wrote, here in exile, I have participated in the sanctuary movement as a refugee. The movement has given me protection and Through it, I have had the opportunity to share my experiences and the experiences of the people who live in my country. But even with this protection, I don't feel secure because I know that one day I can be arrested by immigration for speaking of my people. I even know that there could be people sitting, that there could be people listening to me to put me at risk. And these sorts of testimonies continue. Manuel Rodriguez in the Pacific Northwest testified that he hopes sanctuary would, that his presence there would contribute to the North American people's understanding of the reality of human rights and all of its abuses. And speaking prophetically, Alfredo, and a lot of these are, I mean, all these cases actually, these are pseudonyms. Alfredo wrote that, I know my words are like seeds in the ground, and later we will be able to harvest good fruit in the future. So here I'm going to share some dimensions of the testimonials that I don't have the time to really flesh out, but I find the images terribly compelling and unnerving. So still currently working out this part on sanctuary caravans, or what organizers call the Overground Railroad. And these rose up in defiance to the arrest of sanctuary organizers in 1984. And these also arose in defiance to the federal indictment against the sanctuary workers announced in January 1985. In short, as the sanctuary movement faced federal pressure, or pressure from the federal government, they doubled down on their sacred resistance. Again, at a time when the government was really starting to clamp down on them. So the family on the right went on the Overground Railroad, traveling through much of the Midwest, Chicago, and ended up in Vermont. I'm showing another example of these Overground Railroads. In slide 15 here, on the left, one of the flyers for the Freedom Train of the Sanctuary Caravan responding to the federal indictments against sanctuary workers. So they started symbolically in Phoenix and traveled much of the, what people call flyover country, after the trip here, I get it, from Massachusetts, and stopped for a longer trip in Chicago. And ultimately, the family took refuge. So the last service, I should point out, actually, the last service was in Northampton, right across the bridge from where I teach. And the family took refuge in a Quaker meeting house about 20 minutes north from where I live. Okay, and again, to give you a sense of what these overground, what the Overground Railroad is meant to evoke, a quote from the Sanctuary periodical published out of Chicago, Basta, in 1985, the caravan surpassed everyone's expectations, and the key to this was a powerful witness of the refugees. The depth and breadth of their experiences and their ability to communicate through music, poetry, dance, theater, prayer, worship, and preaching enabled the spirit to be present, to be experienced, and for people's lives to be affected. Now, again, I don't have the time to go into this today, but I have recently published about sanctuary refugees and really challenging our concept of sanctuary leaders. I reconceptualize refugees as leaders of the movement. Why? You don't have the sanctuary movement without the refugees' testimonials. They're the ones who spur the movement into action. So the Sanctuary Declaration Service at Stanislaus Presbyterian Church in Tucson. One more quick slide. About the testimonies and testimonials, the voice of the martyrs. Can't discuss witnesses without mention of martyrs. The term martyrs itself drawing from the Greek term martus, right, which means witness, and you have folks who paid the ultimate price with their life. Oscar Romero, the Salvadoran Archbishop, was assassinated while offering mass at a hospital. He wrote, they can kill me, but not the voice of justice. And so the sanctuary movement was very intentional about always remembering those who have passed away and were martyrs for human rights in Central America. It includes Oscar Romero, Rutilio Grande, the first priest killed during the Central American Civil Wars, Hermana Silvia, and this idea that even though they have passed on, they have risen in the struggle of the people, or viven en la lucha del pueblo. Okay, continuing on. The Sanctuary Declaration Service at Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson set a new tone of sacred resistance. Scheduled for March 24, 1982, the service commemorated the two-year anniversary of the assassination of Oscar Romero. On that day, a Salvadoran man, who assumed the name Alfredo, and his family, publicly took refuge at Southside Presbyterian, as shown there on the slide. As more than 40 news reporters looked on, speakers reprimanded the Reagan administration for its heavy hand in fueling U.S. proxy wars in Central America and for denying refugee status to those fleeing violence from especially Guatemala and El Salvador. Offering unsanctioned refuge, however, amounted to, let's be clear, civil disobedience, since harboring and transporting undocumented immigrants violated federal law. That day, two banners hung outside of the church. You can't see all the words necessarily in the photograph from 82, but in the photo I took of these replicas of the banners in 2018, we read on the left, La migra no profana santuario, immigration officers shall not profane the sanctuary. La migra, short for the immigration, which means, you know, nowadays ICE, Border Patrol, and really anyone falling under DHS that functions any kind of law enforcement. And on the right, Este es el santuario de Dios para los oprimidos de Centroamérica. This is the sanctuary of God for the oppressed of Central America. So a very clear demarcation of sacred space. In their search for a higher authority to justify their actions, sanctuary supporters at Southside Presbyterian prepared a media packet complete with one document that was titled Historical and Theological Basis for Sanctuary. This document was the eighth in nine such documents and was preceded by items such as Alfredo's own testimony, the congregation's letter that was addressed to then Attorney General William French Smith, outlining the congregation's intent to break law, the U.S. law. Other items included a list of endorsers from other churches in the area and nationally, showing that they were not alone in the sanctuary declaration. These other congregations similarly turned to sacred histories of refuge traditions to justify their civil disobedience. And in trying to find precedents of sacred refuge, they found a whole lot to draw upon. Their belief, as well as that of approximately 500 congregations across the country, maintained that their declaration aligned with hundreds, if not thousands, of years of sanctuary traditions. Now, onto a key feature of the declaration, something I call usable sacred histories. Congregations across the country turned to sacred history in search of precedents to legitimate their claim of sanctuary and to create a sacred or inviolable place of refuge. At their core, these various attempts to leverage usable sacred histories pointed to a shared sense that sanctuary, in the words of one rabbi from New York City, that sanctuary constituted, quote, a historic and hallowed principle in religious life. By usable sacred histories in this context, I refer to a series of historical traditions that sanctuary supporters imagined to be connected by practice across time and across geography. Again, to be very clear to a professionally trained historian, the connections appear to be tenuous at times, but their cogency really lies in the plenitude of the sanctuary supporters' imagined tradition. Like the usable past, which offers a retrospective reconstruction to serve the needs of the present, these usable sacred histories anchored congregations in a particular historical practice, that is, the tactic of offering refuge to the persecuted. So these were usable in that they were applicable in modern times, sacred in that they drew from scripture and or religious practices to stand apart from and to critique the state, right? If you're not involved in the state or doing this work in collaboration with it, you can stand apart from and give you an important platform to critique the state. And they were history in that advocates by and large believe these to be actual historical instances of refuge. These were not simply myths or kind of these mytho-histories. Sanctuary leaders summoned usable sacred histories to make moral, theological, historical, and seemingly universal claims by appealing to sanctuary's ostensible timelessness. Oh, it's happened since the times of the ancient Egyptians, since the times of the Visigoths, since the times of ancient Rome, as well as its ubiquity. Oh, we have instances of refuge traditions in East Asia, in Hawaii, in the ancient Greco-Roman times. So again, the timelessness and the ubiquity are key here for their claim. Such sanctuary practices represented an age-old expression of the biblical tradition of our faiths, claimed the disciples of Christ in a denomination-wide resolution. The Methodist Reverend Professor Justo Gonzalez added how sanctuary was, quote, a continuation of one of the longest traditions in Christian history. So here, for the short remainder of the talk, I lay out very briefly in chronological order the genres of the usable sacred histories that informed the imagination of sanctuary organizers in the 80s. Again, It was the weightiness of the historical tradition that provoked a key rationale to declare sanctuaries off limits to immigration officers. Tapping into this history of protective sacred space thereby justified the practice for many. So first, perhaps not surprisingly, the Hebrew Bible. And no source lent congregations and especially synagogues a sense of ancient historical and religious precedent and authority more so than the Hebrew Bible. Sanctuary found its most direct origins in passages of the cities of refuge, such as in Numbers 35. These were cities meant to be places where one accused of manslaughter could flee to save their life from the blood avenger. The blood avenger was usually the closest of kin of the person that was slain, and they would seek to slay the accused. Sorry, I get a little tongue-tied there. Sanctuary supporters drew connections between the ancient blood feuds of the crisis, between ancient blood feuds and the crisis developing in Central America, arguing that sanctuary offered in their houses of worship were modern manifestations of the ancient Israelite cities of refuge. Such rationale was evident, for example, in Southside Presbyterian's 1984 reaffirmation of sanctuary, which reads, "This is the time and we're the people to provide sanctuary for those fleeing the blood vengeance of the powers that be in Central America." So resonant was this language from the Hebrew Bible that LA, Oakland, and San Francisco each adopted the label City of Refuge in their sanctuary declaration from 1985 and 1986. Hebrew Bible passages further provided a basis for the language of, quote, welcoming the stranger and the language of exile. There's also the example of theologian and ethicist Robert McAfee Brown at the 1985 Sanctuary Symposium. So again, Sanctuary Symposium happens late January 85, 10 or 12 or 14 days after the federal government announced these indictments against the sanctuary workers and the sanctuary trial in Tucson. So there's really particular sort of heated moment there. So he declared at the Sanctuary Symposium in 85, or he drew out the parallels even more provocatively between Hebrew Bible passages and sanctuary, claiming that, quote, "The modern Pharaoh, the contemporary Caesar, resides in Washington." And in that quote, he's figuratively placing the scepter of oppression in Reagan's hand. But let's get to the time of the actual Caesar, the New Testament. Okay? Totally, it's a bit of a whiplash history through a lot of time, so do fasten your seatbelts, okay? So the New Testament, the opening chapters of the New Testament, tell stories of refuge and flight. As pictured here, sanctuary activists found strong parallels between the Holy Family's flight to and refuge in Egypt and the Central American refugee crisis they were witnessing. The famous Advent passage from Matthew chapter 2 became not only usable but also sacred, especially in Christmas time. Amid the months-long deliberations as to whether Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson should declare itself a sanctuary, a refugee family was reunited during the Christmas Eve service after a long time being separated. And Pastor John Fife reminded his congregation, quote, "I'm supposed to say something about the gospel text tonight, but I think there is no doubt that we have seen the gospel tonight. This is what the Bible calls a sign. Christ is present in the refugees and in sanctuary." And on the slide, we have the example of the refugee family supplicating in translation here, "In the name of God, we ask you for shelter." And the word used here for shelter or in, posada, that draws explicitly from Christmas time traditions in Latin America and rituals and such. So again, it has a particular kind of valence that would have been readily understood by Latin Americans in the U.S. And further to draw some of the language of the New Testament, the idea that Jesus was an alien and a refugee added poignancy to the well-known text of Matthew 25, "I was a stranger and you invited me." This was for a manual for Overground Railroad hosts, folks who would host refugees that would be taken from one safe house to the next, from one church to the next. So they were reminded of that in their very own training material. Okay. So though not quite as timeless as ancient sanctuary, we turn to the medieval church and medieval sanctuary. This proved a favorite for those wishing to articulate, let's say, more recognizable templates and concrete examples of refuge in churches. Scholars of this period enjoyed access to more precise details of sanctuary cases how long someone stayed in sanctuary, the location of sanctuary, the nature of the alleged crime committed, the particular names of sanctuary seekers, and the sanctuaries in which they sought refuge. The 1,000-year period of sanctuary in the Middle Ages, from 400 to 1500, thoroughly anchored the practice in Christian history, and modern historiography has ensured it was readily available as a usable past, especially for sanctuary organizers. Pastor Gustav Schultz of Berkeley's United Lutheran Church played no small role in prevailing upon the city of Berkeley's council members to adopt the nation's very first sanctuary resolution. Not in the 80s, though, okay? Actually, in 1971, in his effort to provide sanctuary for Vietnam War resistors. The resolution cited how, quote, religious sanctuaries were respected by state authorities in medieval Europe. The city of Berkeley and Pastor Schultz again worked together in the 1980s to pass a new sanctuary resolution for Central American refugees. And one thing we should note about the medieval period, this is by and large Catholic history. So Catholics drew upon a wide array of icons and figures, with none rivaling the importance of the witness and martyr, namely, who I mentioned before, Oscar Romero, and the four missionary the four women missionaries who were brutally murdered in Central America in 1980. Sisters Mara Clark and Ida Ford, both Marianelle sisters, Sister Dorothy Kazel, Ursuline, and lay missionary Jean Donovan. And I guess just a hop, skip, jump, and windy road away. We have Los Angeles right nearby. Should I say Los Angeles, Santa Barbara? No, is it a bad thing to say? Okay, it's okay to say Los Angeles, sorry. We have plenty of examples of sanctuary in Los Angeles and these buildings and centers commemorating those who were assassinated in Central America. There's the Centro Pastoral Rutilio Grande. Again, he's the first priest assassinated during the Central American Civil Wars, and the efforts led there in Los Angeles by Father Luis Olivares. It was not uncommon in the litanies of remembrance cited or recited in the sanctuary declaration services to recall the martyrs who had given their lives. Now, if Dr. Amaro Garcia had been here, he'd really appreciate this. This is actually an image that he used in his book, but it's from the UCLA Charles Young Research Library, a sanctuary declaration service in Los Angeles. Importantly, I should note, on December 12, 1985, that's the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So to a lesser, though no less significant extent, Latino Catholics in the U.S. readily deploy the power and the pathos of the most widely celebrated religious symbol and icon in the Americas, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Father Luis Olivares declared sanctuary at La Placita Church on December 12, 1985, again, the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And Olivares argued that because Guadalupe had embraced Juan Diego, the humble Indian peasant, as it's termed. Juan Diego, by the way, was the one who encountered Guadalupe in this Marian apparition in Mexico City, 1531. Olivares argued that because she embraced Juan Diego, sanctuary activists should do the same, welcoming Central American refugees. So a poem read in Spanish that day, and offered here in translation, made the connections even more explicit. Our Lady of Guadalupe, protect the new Juan Diegos among us. Help us bring an end to the violence in Central America. Bring justice to these nations torn by the war until peace finally comes. Help us have love and compassion towards these Juan Diego refugees. So again, making really clear connections to Catholic history in the Americas as well. Also, not to leave out U.S. histories, the notion of religious and political refugees settling in English colonies lent sanctuary legitimacy as a long-standing practice, not just in the continent, but in the U.S. Many within the sanctuary movement understood the English Americas to be a land of sanctuary. Think of places like New Haven, right, in Connecticut, and a place to flee from every form of oppression and persecution. No precedent in American history evokes such inspiring stories of sanctuary as did the 19th century Underground Railroad for fugitive slaves. The network of churches and safe houses that transport migrants from Central America through Mexico and into the U.S. Was referred to as the New Underground Railroad. Destinations included sanctuaries in the U.S., again, safe houses, and urban centers where sometimes refugees would go into anonymity, or sometimes to our friendly neighbors to the north, O Canada. For these reasons and more, many even called us the sanctuary movement, as you see, again, on the left, one of the first books on the sanctuary movement, The New Underground Railroad, written by sanctuary insiders and scholars, and then also the recreation of a play about the spirit of Harriet Tubman, how the sanctuary movement is embodying some of the same sort of ethos in moving folks clandestinely through networks. Okay. Finally, we have another usable sacred history, the Holocaust. So in addition to offering examples to emulate, usable sacred histories also taught lessons about what not to do. References to the failures of Christians to protect Jews during the Holocaust stirred the noncommittal out of their apathy. Cautionary tales and comparisons to Nazi Germany's genocide of Jews filled the pages of the sanctuary movement declarations, speeches, and position papers. The admonitions against inaction served like none other to reinforce the conviction of needing to provide aid to refugees, even if it meant engaging in civil disobedience. Far too much regret lay on the side of inaction. Comparisons to Nazi Germany offered a readily recognizable manner through which to draw attention to the severity of the developing crisis at hand. As the 20th century wore on, more cases of mass death and genocide persuaded sanctuary writers to invoke the Holocaust to highlight the potential and end result of unchecked state-sanctioned violence. William Sloan Coffin admonished participants gathered at his Riverside Church in New York City in the 1984 Sanctuary Declaration Service to, quote, realize what German churches learned too late some 40 years ago. It is not enough to resist with confession. We must confess with resistance. One conservative Jewish committee in Seattle relayed how, quote, our tradition is replete with examples of such actions from the demands for freedom of our people enslaved in Egypt to the Maccabean Revolt, to the rebellion of the Bar Kokhba, to the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. The presence, and really also the imprimatur, of the 20th century's most famous refugee and advocate for human rights offered sanctuary movement organizers further justification for their cause. Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel delivered his famous remarks on the refugee at the aforementioned 1985 Sanctuary Symposium in Tucson. In his statement, he reminded the audience that aiding refugees is a human thing to do. Also at the conference for the first time, he famously shared or declared, no human being is illegal. Again, that's attributed to a declaration he made at the conference. Now to move on to the conclusion. So no sanctuary declaration justification paper was ever complete without the mention of human rights. Congregations regularly reference international law to show the universality of their claims regarding refugees. Article 3 of the Geneva Convention in 1945, Helsinki Accords, the 1951 UN Convention relating to status of refugees, its update basically in 67, the UN Protocol relating to the status of refugees, and also importantly for Americans, the Refugee Act of 1980. If scripture and a profound historical tradition of sanctuary were not reason enough, then perhaps the force of international law could change hearts and minds. Ultimately, usable sacred histories were critical to the sanctuary movement's success, but they built upon the testimonies that were delivered by the refugees themselves. These usable sacred histories allowed both movement insiders and outsiders to interpret their convictions in light of the historical and religious depth of this tradition. Combining millennia of sacred history with modern conscience, religious leaders crafted a narrative sanctuary that justified their civil disobedience as sacred, or some current sanctuary organizers saying, God's executive order. Together, all these usable sacred histories conveyed the gravitas of the movement in declaring sanctuary and the moment in which they declared sanctuary. The declaration of sanctuary at Southside Presbyterian Church that we return here on the slide to on March 24, 1982, as just one of many examples, invoked much of the weight of the historical tradition of refuge and thus marked the precincts of the sanctuary as protected and ideally inviolable. It cannot be violated, right? Not to be breached by immigration enforcement. As it turned out in the 1980s, sanctuary seekers were not arrested in houses of worship. Refugees and their supporters had indeed carved out a refuge of resistance.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.